morning and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. With me this morning, I'd like to welcome Senator Hughes, our Vice Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Senator Stephens. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is about 10:15 on April 7, 2017, and I apologize for the delay in the start of the committee. It's a really busy time of year, and I appreciate everybody's patience. We try to keep everybody up to date on the status of the time, but appreciate you coming back. We have several bills on the agenda today, and then we also plan on meeting again this afternoon, so if anything spills over, we have that opportunity. The first bill is Senate Bill 80. It's the bill that I've introduced related to telecommunications. This is the bill's second hearing. It's the intent to adopt the committee substitutes and look to the will of the take any members' questions and then look to the will of the committee. And my aide, Portia Hazleton, is also here to answer any questions. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Hughes, would you like to move the committee substitute?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I move the committee adopt work order LS-0631 Juliet as the working document.
Okay, and I'll object for the sake of explanation. Sorcia, please feel free to introduce yourself and explain the committee substitute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sorcia Hazleton, staff to Senator Costello. Before you is the CS. It incorporates changes discussed by the public testimony in the last hearing. It incorporates person-first language as well as the suggestion to change organizations representing the deaf, hard of hearing, and speech-disabled to organizations whose principal purpose is to provide these services. So the changes are on page 1, line 8, to subscribers who are deaf, hard of hearing, and speech-disabled. Page 1, line 12, subscribers of telecommunication services who are deaf, hard of hearing, and speech disabled. Page 2, line 5, a person who is certified as deaf, hard of hearing, or speech disabled by a licensed physician. And page 2, line 8 and 9, that represents or has a principal purpose to provide services to persons who are deaf, hard of hearing, or speech disabled.
Do members need a moment to look over those changes in the bill?
Okay.
Senator Hughes?
I'm just wondering if we clarify, there was some question whether by broadening the word going from telephone to telecommunications, was if that was going to bring any new companies under the umbrella that have not been charging customers this surcharge and offering this service, and are they aware of that if that's the case?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, I did clarify that with the Regulatory Commission. On page 1, line 6 of the bill, it does say the commission shall adopt regulations requiring telecommunications utilities to provide services. The surcharge is on the subscriber rather than the utility, and through regulation, RCA takes the defines telecommunications more narrowly for the purposes of their surcharge. So the purpose in changing this from telephone to telecommunications allows them to change their regulations more frequently than we would want to change statute.
Senator Hughes?
So the bottom line, will there be new companies that fit under this that aren't charging that to their subscribers, or it will be the existing companies that are doing it? Does it just change the rate?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, no. It would just be for any company that currently provides telephone service is already paying the surcharge, and so since the regulations adopted currently just charge telephones, that will stay the same. So there shouldn't be any new companies.
No. Okay, thank you for that clarification.
I'll remove my objection, and the committee substitute is adopted. Are there any further questions of committee members? Seeing none, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move CS for SB 80 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, are there any objections to moving the bill? Okay, seeing none, the bill moves. We'll take a brief at ease and invite Senator Stephen Staff up as we go through Senate Bill 95 during that at ease.
Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Next on our agenda is a bill introduced by Senator Stevens and his aide, Tim, is here. This is the bill's second hearing. The intent is to take any lingering questions from committee members and then look to the will of the committee. Are there any questions?
Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens?
This is a pretty exciting bill, and the more I learn about it, as we've introduced and heard from other folks, the more excited it does become. The potential is just really tremendous with the amount of ocean that we have in Alaska, clean water, and the possibility of developing shellfish and seaweed, and even we heard about algae as a fuel source. It's really remarkable, and you've heard from Julie Decker saying that her belief is that in 30 years this will be a $1 billion industry, so really add to our economy, and pretty exciting.
I agree, Senator Stevens, and I signed on as a co-sponsor and was able to drag several individuals yesterday to join me, and I think it's just a great economic diversification and economic development bill, so thank you for introducing it. Senator Hughes.
Before I make that comment, I just want to say that I appreciate the bill too, and all those things that help our economy in the state are awesome, but there's one rather selfish reason that I like it is the thought that someday we'll be able to get shellfish in our local grocery stores because I love to eat it. So with that, Madam Chair, I move SB 95 from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Bill 95? Okay. So moved. We'll take a brief at ease. Good morning, and Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is back in order. I did want to mention for those who've been patiently waiting, we will have a meeting this afternoon. I know there are individuals online waiting for this particular bill. Senate Bill 85, we will be hearing at our 3:30 meeting this afternoon. So if you're online for that bill, I wanted to let you know, and I appreciate your patience at this busy time of year. So thank you very much for your patience. The next item on the agenda is the boards and commissions. The plan is to conclude the committee's review on the governor's appointees to the boards and commissions. We have kept public testimony open until this point. Is there anyone online or in the room that would like to comment on the governor's appointments that have been reviewed by our committee? Okay. Seeing none, I will close public testimony on the governor's appointments. Wanted to ask members if you have any final questions or comments before we move to or we report out the slate of appointees, which is essentially not an indication of voting yes for them, but just moves them on so that the process can continue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes.
I just want to thank all of those who've stepped up. We had quite an array of people, very talented, mm-hmm. dedicated people, and I just appreciate their willingness to serve, Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes, would you like to read the language to move the names?
All right. In accordance with AS 39.05080, the Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the attached nominees and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals.
Okay. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the document. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on the agenda is Senate Bill 62. This has been introduced by Senator Wilson. And Senator Wilson, welcome, and thank you for being here to watch as your bill has its second hearing. This is the repeal of the Certificate of Need program in the state. That's what the bill would do. This is the bill's second hearing. The intent is to conclude invited testimony, take members' questions, and then set the bill aside. And the first person that we're going to hear from is Mr. David Morgan. He's the Economic Director of Alaskan Institute for Economic Growth. David, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. So please feel free to provide your comments on this legislation.
Okay. My comments are about 12 minutes because a lot of it was taken care of Friday. So even the documents that I sent you, I'm just going to skip over those parts. A little more background. Live in Anchorage. I was chairman of the Municipal Healthcare Commission for 6 years, and I was on the State Healthcare Commission for 4.5 years representing primary care clinics. And I'm currently finishing up my PhD, and my thesis is on healthcare cost drivers, which is what we're really talking about here. And I also was a contributor to the Commonwealth North study on the budget for 2017, and one of the principals on the healthcare systems with Charisse. So first, I had a long introduction, but that was handled by the witnesses yesterday. I would like to detail more of the economic impacts of Certificate of Need. And I did provide a paper provided by the FTC that talked about in their studies, along with the professor that also spoke, who spoke mainly on quality, but they looked at cost drivers and costs. And in several markets in several states, they did equate a certificate in need of adding cost to developing new construction and new equipment, but also the time involved in when there was objection by current holders or owners or nonprofits that had facilities to try to stop competition coming into their area. The one part of history that wasn't discussed, though there was a lot of discussion on it by Senator Wilson, is the first national law relating to this issue was, and there's probably just a few of us that remember it, Hill-Burton Act of 1946. And basically, because they could not get capital to build or renovate hospitals in the 40s and 50s, Hill-Burton provided money for hospital construction. But they basically paid it off by giving charity care at cost, which offset those costs. That was then, in 1974, basically unfunded and left out because of competition and capital and chains, especially for profit, started moving in, and it was found unnecessary for the federal government to provide money to build hospitals in that regard. The rest of the history of the bill has already been covered, so there's no point rehashing it. We all know that 14 states had discontinued their CON program. New Hampshire was the most recent, effective 2016. 34 have kept their CON, including Alaska. And that you should also include Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the District of Columbia. Three states have certificate of need, but they have slight variations. And one of the addendums to my report that was put into the record was a detail from the National Governors Association that detailed each CON program in each state. Even if they don't have one, they simply said no program, and when they left the process. So there's no need to go into 50 programs here. We're talking about Alaska.
And Mr. Morgan, I just wanted to mention that we do have the document that you provided, and we also have an individual who's here to provide additional invited testimony. So if you could actually, instead of taking the full 12 minutes, perhaps, on the shorter side of 10 minutes would be really great for the committee.
You got it. I'm on the last half page here. What we really have found, that especially with the advent of ACA and the current health plans that are in force, that markets and the current healthcare economics and the reimbursement formats that states have been going through over the last 10 years has really made a lot of what happens with the certificate in need a duplicate process and has increased costs. When you actually look at when you're doing this, to build a facility or to build a surgery center or the covered areas, that the certificates and licenses and zoning requirements needed from JCO to municipalities, zoning, public hearings, it's just it's another layer on top of what's going on. And last here, the changes in the Medicare payment system, especially on hospital DRGs, outpatient ancillary services, have made a lot of the issue of people building facilities and then them being empty. It just doesn't happen anymore. But sheer cost and process, the market itself has made redundancy uneconomical and financially unviable. And I think if you really look at this, that this should be left to the economics of each institution rather than being subject to a worldview, a state view, or how we operate the healthcare markets in themselves. By restricting new construction or adding on the price and the time delays has basically reduced price competition between facilities and helped keep prices high. As detailed by the Bureau of Economics Federal Trade Commission and their study on the effects of state certification of need laws on hospitals especially, it's becoming more of a wall to getting new equipment, more up-to-date programs, and reducing competition with new innovation out of the markets where organizations have to go through that. And that's why you're seeing, especially in Alaska, Hawaii, and other locations where it's tough to do that, is you're seeing organizations like the Alaska Healthcare Underwriters, which basically has had for the last 8 years a standard practice of sending non-emergency cases, especially surgery, out of state, where they, including the cost of travel and accommodations, able to get services at less than half the price, like at the Cleveland Clinic and major institutions in Seattle and the Mayo Clinic, which are not substandard or less than quality organizations. I'd like to also add, which I did leave out, that virtually every step in the building process, especially in Anchorage, to get any kind of licensing, permitting, and zoning, you have to have public hearings anyway. So the public does have input, on several steps through the process simply by the new updated laws and regulations that are in place. And then finally, you'll find that a lot of the times the interests of the community may not entail things like outside factors like transportation, marketing, or institutional prestige. The one instance I can remember as anecdotally was at one point here in this in Midtown, a road that would have allowed ambulances get from some Representative Sadler's area 10 to 15 minutes faster. And we have an old saying in healthcare, time is tissue to the top-rated trauma centers, and then at the same time deny a certificate need for emergency center so they could at least get some beds to handle these cases, were disconnected. So at the end of the process, we found that we didn't have the small road so the ambulance could get here quicker from his area, but on the other hand, the certificate of need was denied so that they couldn't even build a small facility emergency center to capture those patients, to stabilize them, to get to the other emergency center, which wasn't as highly rated at that on the other side of town. So basically, my written testimony, my 84 document from the Federal Trade Association, and my list of all the other programs are included. For Senator Stevens, while I was listening yesterday, I found a study that's being developed, which I'll get to you, on cost. And it's basically a comparison of states that have certificate of need or don't have it, whether or not they have a public utility review commission, like Indiana for health care, to review hospitals and ancillary care rates and payer mix. And what's interesting is the one state that had all four of those, including a robust rate review process for the last 10 years, was Indiana. And in 2016, their individual insurance premium rate increases were -3% without the con and with these other four. They're the only ones that had all four boxes checked.
Mr. Morgan?
I'll send that along, especially to Senator Stevens, so he could see that.
Thank you. And Mr. Morgan, we will make sure, if you can get that to my staff, we will share it with not only Senator Stevens, but all of the members of the committee. And I want to thank you for making yourself available. If members have questions of Mr. Morgan, if you could get those to me in writing, and we will make sure we get your answers. We're going to take a brief at ease now where we ask our next invited guest to come forward. Senate Labor and Commerce is called back to order. Next we have Becky Holtberg, who's with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and she has a presentation for us. And Becky, I want to thank you for your patience. I know you were here yesterday and this morning too, and if your presentation takes longer than the time we do have time this afternoon. So with that, welcome, and please feel free to give your comments.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. I may have a little more slides than time, but I think we can get through. So I'll breeze over a couple and happy to follow up or answer any questions if I don't get to the detail. Before I start the PowerPoint, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. First of all, ASHNA's position on this bill, we do not support a full repeal of Certificate of Need at this time. However, we agree that it is appropriate to review the CRN program to determine if it's accomplishing its intent, if it's adequately enforced, and if changes are merited. We believe that this process should be done collaboratively and that it should be informed by data. It will not take years to do this. I believe it doesn't have to be a long process, and I don't know of a provider group at this point in time that I'm aware of that would oppose such a collaborative process. Second, I need to clarify on the record the role of hospitals in granting privileges to a physician to practice within a hospital. It was stated yesterday that there's fear among some providers regarding loss of privileges with an implication that hospitals would revoke privileges if providers supported CON repeal. Hospitals and providers work collaboratively together in the community to take care of patients. In fact, there's more of a spirit of collaboration today than any time that I've worked in this field. The challenges we face unite us more than they divide us. But more importantly, hospital administrators, hospital CEOs, do not grant medical privileges. Privileges are granted or revoked through a physician-led process that focuses on the qualifications, work performance, and education of the applicant. So I think it's important to state pretty strongly that to assert that a hospital would revoke privileges based on a provider's view of CON is without merit. So getting into the slides, I've listed here in the presentation some key questions that I think should be answered through the CON process. I'm not going to go over them because you have them in front of you. But I think these are the things as we work our way through what is a necessarily complicated issue, but yet a very important issue for our healthcare infrastructure, that we factor in these questions. So you've heard that hospitals are very profitable, and I'm going to show you a couple slides that I'll breeze through here pretty quickly on some of the headwinds faced by the hospital industry. This slide shows the number of rural hospital closures since 2010. We're fortunate in Alaska that we haven't had any small hospital closures, but there's always the potential for that. So when comments are made about the profitability of hospitals, they're often referring in Alaska to hospitals on the rail belt, whereas the majority of our membership are small rural hospitals. Some are tribal, some are non-tribal. Hospitals in Kodiak, Seward, Valdez, Homer, Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, and Cordova are small, non-tribal, critical access hospitals under 25 beds. Those are the hospitals most at risk in the current reimbursement environment. They have thin margins, not a great payer mix, and they face increasing challenges. And again, we have not had a hospital closure in Alaska, but given the economy and payment reductions, it is not impossible. And finally, I just want to note that most of our hospitals in Alaska are not owned by systems out of the state. Most of them are owned by the community that they serve. By my count, only 4 hospitals in our state are owned by an outside entity, and one of those hospitals has a significant investor presence by the local foundation. So again, I'm going to go through these very quickly, but a couple of the challenges faced by hospitals. Lower inpatient use, which can be a good thing, but is a trend if you're in the hospital business that you pay attention to. Inpatient volumes are declining. Medicare cuts are real and significant. This graph shows you Medicare cuts for Alaska hospitals over 15 years, $856 million. And again, these are real cuts taken by Alaska hospitals to Medicare reimbursement. The next one is Medicaid cuts. I don't know if you've heard, but the administration is reducing Medicaid rates by 5% starting July 1st to help keep the Medicaid budget flat. So I want to highlight here, just spend a quick minute on Medicaid reimbursement. Our member facilities, hospitals and nursing homes, are reimbursed based on cost. So when you have a high percentage of Medicaid, some of our providers up as much as 90%, these are typically skilled nursing facilities, you can't operate if you're reimbursed based on cost, but your reimbursement is declining, you can't operate in a cost-minus environment for very long. So I think it's an important thing to note about our facilities. And it was discussed, it was talked about yesterday that the history of CON stems from a time when the federal government reimbursed based on cost. Well, in Alaska, we still do reimburse based on cost. So the goal of the CON program, I want to spend just a minute. For the proponents of repeal, it's to restrain the growth of healthcare costs. We've spent a lot of time talking in this committee on this issue in the last 2 hearings on healthcare cost. And the methodology is competition reduces prices, and thus is going to lower cost. So increasing competition through CON repeal is going to lower prices and restrain cost. We have to add to that analysis of CON the impact on quality, the impact on access to care for underserved populations, and the use of CON as a tool for public accountability and transparency. We're talking a lot about price transparency in this building right now, and the current CON process provides a level of visibility on cost and on facility growth that we would not have visibility on otherwise.
Becky, thank you so much for what you've shared so far. I just wanted to ask about the underserved populations. We heard
in the previous testimony that there are methods to cover indigent populations, and are you aware of any of those methods if we were to somehow scale back CON or even repeal it?
Chair Costello, I don't know specifically what they were referring to. I mean, typically the method would be a direct payment to a hospital or mm-hmm. that sees a high percentage of underserved. That would be like the Medicare, Medicaid DSH funds or those types of payments. So it's not without cost. It would end up being just some kind of a direct subsidy.
Thank you.
So competition, we've talked about competition, about whether or not, you know, CON will increase competition. And I think the question we have to ask is, do we have competition now? And the reality is, the CON program in its current state has significant, we would call them loopholes, a physician office exemption, there's lax enforcement, and there's the ability to move facilities. So for small outpatient imaging or surgery centers, we actually do have significant competition already. CON has limited high-cost, capital-intensive things like surgery centers, large surgery centers, and expensive hospital expansions. It's also limited the development of skilled nursing facilities. But I think to imply that there's not competition right now is a significant misunderstanding of the market.
I have a question.
Senator Hughes.
And I'm sorry because I wasn't here yesterday, so I maybe missed something, Madam Chair. But, Becky, the physician office exemption, can you explain what that is?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes. Offices of physicians, like sort of a private physician's office, is exempt from the requirements of certificate of need. So if you're a physician and you want to put an MRI in your office, you're not falling under the CON threshold at this point.
And follow up?
Senator Hughes?
So even if it hits the dollar amount threshold, if it's as long as it's located in the office, it's not...
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's my understanding, but we will come back with a clarification and confirm. I'm not necessarily the technical expert in the program itself.
Thank you.
So I think the question really then is, does CON repeal address our cost problem? And I've listed a variety of factors and a citation regarding what are the factors commonly cited as driving healthcare costs. Certificate of need is not on this list because, quite frankly, when you talk about the things driving healthcare costs, they are primarily related to the structure of our healthcare system, fee-for-service. I would add into this list that's on many others, just not this one, the third-party payment system, where the consumer is not purchasing the service and therefore is disconnected from the cost of the service. And then I'll highlight here in a couple of minutes the role of medical technology. But lack of competition in the healthcare market is not commonly cited as a driver of healthcare costs. And there's a quote there, I think, that underscores that finding. So looking at it from a global perspective, we've all heard how expensive the United States is relative to other countries. A study from the Commonwealth Fund that is linked here unpacked that to find out what are the differences between U.S. healthcare and other countries. There are really two factors. The one is higher U.S. healthcare costs, which I think can be directly related to the fee-for-service system, which means fee-for-service means we're doing more stuff to more people. Providers are paid not based on the health of a population, but based on each procedure, each test, each visit. The third-party payer system. In the third-party payer system, so higher healthcare costs and higher utilization of high-priced medical technology. So when we talk about increasing medical access to medical technology, as the person from Mercatus Center said yesterday, we're going to have 10 more hospitals in Alaska. We're going to have lots more surgery centers and lots more MRIs. We have to ask ourselves the question, is more better in healthcare? Because more is part of what is driving our costs. Because physical infrastructure gets paid for by someone. This graph up here demonstrates, if you look at MRIs, CT, and then what's commonly known as a PET, I will not try to pronounce all those words, different sophisticated diagnostic imaging. If you look at the numbers of the United States versus other countries, we actually are a little behind Japan, which doesn't surprise me because they're so technologically focused. But look at the numbers, 8.8 MRI machines per million in Canada and 35 in the U.S. The question is, do we need more care? Are we sicker? Or are we just higher utilizers of expensive technology? I think the answer is pretty clear. We're just higher utilizers of expensive technology. Healthcare versus a normal market, and I'm really going to fly here. Not going to go through this slide, but there's some information here that demonstrates from an economic perspective why healthcare does not behave as a normal market. It is the factors are very different. This gets a little wonky here, and in the interest of time, I won't get into it too much. This is a supply-demand graph showing you what happens when supply increases, as in the supply of surgery centers in a market. And it does show you that that price often falls, however, quantity increases. So if we are going to create more quantity of health care, it's the Starbucks phenomenon. A Starbucks on every corner means we drink a lot more coffee and we spend a lot more on coffee, even if the per unit price for coffee is a little bit less. So again, kind of touched on these issues, so I'm going to go through them. The key on this slide, though, is that that's assuming the only thing that moves, that changes on that diagram is the supply. If the demand for healthcare goes up in addition to supply, what you will find is that in healthcare, competition can sometimes raise prices too, which is a perfect storm if you care about cost. And how does this happen? Another wonky slide. But here you've got a supply curve moving to the right, which means the supply of something increased, surgery center, but the demand curve moved too. So you went from point A to point C, which meant the price went up and the quantity consumed went up. So you almost doubled your total cost in this scenario. And I'm happy to provide you the graduate level microeconomic textbook reference for these concepts. It's on one of the slides.
Thank you, Becky. I was going to ask where's
it
the
is.
Source.
It's on
the
source. The source is actually, I neglected to copy it. It's on this slide here. That's the source.
Okay.
So I think we need to think about whether or not in the healthcare market itself our traditional assumptions hold true. So I'm going to go through these literature things because I really would like to get to a couple slides here to conclude. This, I think, is an important study that I'll provide to the committee and you can distribute. It's worth reading. It was a study done by the Lewin Group when Illinois looked at eliminating its CON program. And I'm going to be honest here in saying that the economic literature, does not support that CON lowers prices when you compare states. It doesn't support that it raises it either. But what this study found is the traditional arguments for CON are empirically weak. However, given the potential for harm to specific critical elements of the healthcare system, we would advise the Illinois legislature to move forward with an abundance of caution. Non-traditional arguments for maintaining CON deserve consideration until the evidence on the impact that specialty hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers may have on safety net providers can be better quantified. So benefits of CON, again, I'm not going to go through this because I want to get to a kind of a final concept. I will note that there is public involvement and an interest in the government, in the public involvement through the CON process because of the role of the government as a payer. The state of Alaska has a fiscal interest in this issue, and the fiscal note is large because the state of Alaska will pay both for the capital and operating costs through the Medicaid program of any new facilities constructed. And I'll kind of make my final point here. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act is the act that says that hospitals will treat anyone who comes into the emergency room regardless of ability to pay, which is one thing that drives these significant numbers of the high figure you see there for uncompensated care in Alaska hospitals. I would note the Petersburg hospitals on the right, South Peninsula on the bottom, and Providence is that photo on the left. So I found the McDonald's Burger King example yesterday a little bit amusing. It was pointed out how ridiculous it would be if McDonald's had to get a CON to compete with Burger King. But what if the federal government required Burger King to give away its hamburgers for free, but didn't require the same of McDonald's? What does the competitive market look like then? And that's really the impact in the healthcare market of EMTALA, which requires hospitals to provide care regardless of ability to pay. So hospitals subsidize many services that don't generate revenue or where revenue doesn't cover cost. Sexual assault response, I won't read the list. A lot of critical services we take for granted in the community are in fact paid for by hospitals because they also maintain infrastructure and staffing for 24-hour emergency services. These services are provided because hospitals have positive margins on other services. CON repeal and loopholes in the current CON statute allow profitable services and payers to migrate outside of the hospital, leaving hospitals with fewer resources to provide needed community services. So in closing, and again, I'm happy to follow up. I know I ran through some of these slides really fast. I hope not too fast. It's really about what we value. Part of the question is about what we value. What's the value of the community services we provided in our community? What's the value of having certain specialty services that are subsidized by hospitals, especially pediatric specialties, in the community? What services do you want available in your hospital if you or a family member have a medical emergency? And then what is the value of rural hospitals to their communities? These are the things that we need to think about as being at risk if we look to change the program. It's also about who gets care. CLM laws can protect access for the very poor, the very, very sick, those who don't have commercial insurance, and by that Medicare, Medicaid, and the uninsured, rural areas, and urban neighborhoods with high populations of uninsured. So back to the key questions, and then I'm on to my last slide. What problem are we trying to solve? Will CON repeal address this problem? What critical purpose does CON serve? What happens if we get it wrong to our healthcare infrastructure and to our budget? Is now the time? And what information would help inform this conversation? My last slide. So the path forward. Loopholes and lack of enforcement in our current law are very dissatisfying to many of our ASHNA members. We think it's appropriate to have a conversation about whether the law is working as intended and how it could be strengthened or changed. We do not support a full repeal. Alaska's unique provider environment and our unique rural and frontier communities must be part of this conversation. We also recommend that this conversation be informed by data and that the issue be addressed with a stakeholder group to ensure that all perspectives are heard and to ensure that we have a thorough understanding of any unintended consequences of our decision. So with that, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. I'm sure we'll be continuing this conversation. I look forward to that, and I'm always available to answer any questions or to provide any further documentation to the committee.
Thank you, Becky. Appreciate you going through the slides, and members, if you do have any questions, you know, let us know, and we'll make sure that if it's something that you'd like the committee to provide to all the members, we can certainly accommodate that. We have a lot to chew on, and Becky, again, thank you so much, and we will be adjourning until 3:30 this afternoon.